about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Michael Gorman. He'll be answering your most important questions on effective stillwater fly fishing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Michael Gorman about effective stillwater fly fishing. Whether fishing for trout in the Rocky Mountains, chasing silver salmon in Alaska, or jumping tarpon in the Florida Keys, the Platte River Fly Shop online store has all the top brands you will need to gear up for your trip. We are Wyoming's largest Sims and Patagonia dealer, keeping a large variety of popular items in stock year-round. You might even find a great deal in our closeout section, from rods and reels to waders and boots. And if you're headed through Wyoming, be sure to put the Blue Ribbon North Platte River Tailwaters on your bucket list. Log in to WyomingFlyFishing.com. That's WyomingFlyFishing.com today to check our store and or give us a call at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. And you'll be able to chat with our experienced fly shop staff. Before we introduce Michael, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look under the link under Michael's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Michael's book, Effective Stillwater Fly Fishing, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And if you want to learn more about what Stackpole has to offer in the way of books, go to stackpolebooks.com. I want to thank them for offering this book tonight. Here's how you can win Michael's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something Michael and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win that book, Effective Stillwater Fly Fishing. Our guest tonight is Michael Gorman. Michael is founder of Scarlet Ibis Fly Fishing Tours, has been guiding and teaching effective fly fishing skills for more than 30 years. His angling knowledge and skills have been honed in New Zealand, Ireland, Christmas Island, the Bahamas, Florida, Alaska, British Columbia, and all over the western United States, including Oregon's world-famous Deschutes, Rogue River, McKinsey River, and North Umpqua Rivers. He owned and operated his own retail fly fishing shop in Corvallis, Oregon, for many years, also being the head fishing guide. Michael continues still as an Oregon fishing guide throughout the calendar year, in addition to teaching classes at Oregon State University, where he has done so since 1987. For more than 25 years, he taught credit fly fishing classes at OSU. As a professional fly fishing guide throughout the calendar year, Michael focuses his efforts on McKinsey River trout and selected stillwaters, spring and summer, summer and fall steelhead on the South Oregon's Rogue River, and winter steelhead on the Central and North Coast. In addition to authoring Effective Stillwater Fly Fishing, an analytical approach to help you catch more fish, he also wrote Steelhead Fly Angling, Gorilla Fly Rod Tactics, and currently Michael is finishing up a third book on nymph fishing. Well, Michael, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's a good day to be doing this because it's raining outside here in Colorado, so I don't like fishing in the rain. I guess you guys are used to it up there in the Northwest, but
we live in our rain jackets.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, around here, you just when you get a rainy day, it's you know sit on the deck and just watch it fall because it's you know, so unfamiliar.
But Roger, that can be when the fish will bite best. Got to consider
that. Well, let's talk about that tonight. So we've got lots of questions on stillwater fishing, and this is always a hot topic because people seem a little baffled about stillwater fishing and get skunked many times. So what is it about stillwater fly fishing that intimidates anglers?
Well, you know, I address this issue in the first chapter of my book. It's called Fear of Lakes. And the difficulty that people have, myself included, from time to time, is finding the fish, and then once you do, staying with them. They're nomadic, very transient, on the move. So you find them for a while, and then they move on. And it's like, where did they go? So you have to track them down. Contrasting that with rivers, and I guide on a lot of rivers, and the fish are so much easier to find there because they're in very distinctive water and they tend to stay in those. So many good fly fishing friends who are excellent on streams and rivers because they know exactly where the fish have to be, but you put them on a lake and they have grave difficulty. In some cases, they swear never to go back. So finding the fish is at the top of the list, staying with them as they move. Then you've got to deal with some other variables, you know, at what depth are the fish at any given time. And they're also finicky about their food preferences. They can change hour to hour, day to day. And on top of that, let's add a lot of different fly fishing techniques that may be required throughout a single day to catch those fish. And you put all those together, you have some skilled anglers getting weak in the knees, wondering what they're going to do and how they're going to catch a fish. So that's why I wrote the book.
Good. Well, you talk in your book about overcoming that fear and developing confidence. What kind of tips can you give us on doing that?
Well, I'm going to point out the obvious thing first, and that's go fishing with an experienced expert and go at the right time of year. And that's kind of shortcutting the system. Not everybody has that connection. You know, to rely on a friend or an expert that they pay to take them fishing and show them what to do. So let's assume that somebody's going to do it on their own. What I would suggest is do a little background work. For instance, you could read my book, get some ideas of what you want to do, and then I'd target a very specific type of lake or pond. And that would be one that's just been freshly stocked. So it's kind of like training wheels. You know, you can get into the challenge of the wild fish and big lakes later. But if you go to a place where the fish are a little easier to catch, what it does is build up your confidence. If you don't have a trout lake, consider a lake that has crappie and bluegill in them. They tend to overpopulate. They're not going to be big fish, but they are willing players. So you can kind of ease into the game by getting that sense of success of catching some fish. Often the technique or the fly isn't real important for these what I'll consider naive fish. At least the stock trout are going to be naive for a while. But the crappie and then the bluegill, because they're so competitive with each other to eat anything that's available to them, they're really very willing players. So that's what I'd suggest. You know, go with somebody or find an easy-to-fish lake with some naive fish in it. And that'll give you that sense of success, that sense of, I think I got an idea what to do here. And then you can always fall back on that. You can go out to a public lake where the fish are bigger and more wary and there's competition on the lake and see how you do. But you can always retreat back to your training wheels for a little bit until that confidence comes. And I'd certainly, we have a great resource on the Internet with sites like YouTube, where you can plug in any topic, fly fishing lakes, and, you know, you could probably watch videos the rest of your life and get some good ideas of what you need to do. Then it's a matter of getting out there and trying it, make adjustments along the way.
Don't give up too early, huh?
Please don't. Could be the next cast.
Yeah. Well, I noticed you spent quite a bit of time on part of your book talking about a lake, and you're obviously a very accomplished fly fisher and guide and so forth, but a lake that you got skunked on, and yet other people were catching fish. Can you share any lessons from that experience of being totally washed out with all your experience?
Well, I think you may be talking about Roche Lake, British Columbia, up near Kamloops. What a great lake that is. And, yeah, it took me a couple times to fish it to figure it out. And when I first went there, I discovered an area where there were many fish, as registered on my electronic fish finder depth locator. And there were really weren't many people catching fish, just the occasional one there. But I don't know if I'd ever seen so many readings on the little electronic screen indicating that there were fish around me. And tried a variety of techniques, as did my fishing companion for that trip. And it was a washout. I knew the fish were there. I knew they had to eat. Then it was just a matter of trying to formulate a game plan that would enable me to catch those fish. I didn't have much time that first trip and didn't get it figured out, but I wrote a lot about that trip to myself. And some people can be crushed by that experience. You know, it's like, I'm pretty experienced, fished a lot of lakes, caught a lot of fish, and what's going on here? And I guess my outlook was more one of determination, like I'm going to beat this, I'm going to figure it out, whatever it takes. And so subsequently I went back two successive years, and each year got better. And I learned a lot. I learned to eat humble pie. I learned I don't have all the answers, but I'm willing to look for them. So, you know, and people hearing that story, if it offers them some degree of encouragement, knowing that there are going to be days on a lake, a great lake with a lot of fish in it, where they're not going to do so well. Maybe they will get skunked. That if you formulate a good game plan, you think it through, you can come back. And that makes the satisfaction level that much higher when you do finally figure it out, as I did on Roche Lake. So it was really a good lesson at a point in my fishing career where I didn't think I needed to learn too many lessons. Mm-hmm. We know how that can work.
What made that lake so much different than all the other lakes that you had fished?
Well, it's hard to know. It could have been the conditions. One thing that I found at my fault on the lake was getting there at high noon. When I got there, there were a lot of fishermen coming off the lake, and I talked to some who had done quite well, and they actually shared with me the flies that they used. They showed me, one guy handed me one of the flies, and I went out and I used those diligently, so it just could have been a simple matter of timing. And in two subsequent trips and following years to that lake, to Roche Lake, I made sure that I got there reasonably early. We're not talking about break of day, but, you know, 7 to 8 o'clock in the morning. And that could be one of the key elements that's just, you know, can be obvious overlooked. The fish are there. There are a lot of people on the lake apparently trying to catch fish, but the timing's all wrong. It's like the bite had disappeared or it had gone elsewhere on the lake that I didn't locate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it can be little things like that, but that's why in my book I like to emphasize journaling also. Mm-hmm. It's not only therapeutic after a tough day, but it also gives you some ideas of what you want to try next time. It's like, I've got to change something here. What is it that I need to change? And there were things in addition to showing up earlier on the lake, techniques, fly patterns, and all. And one other change I made, I was willing to, Roche Lake is pretty big. It's more than 300 acres, which can be imposing. And I didn't travel far enough on the lake. In subsequent years, I discovered where I needed to be from the particular launch that I took. And the willingness to go farther and finally discover where other people were fishing and fishing well, that was a ticket too. So choosing a different location, a farther location, was also important in the game plan. And anyway,
I remember my father and my son and I were down fishing the San Juan River. And we had fished it the day before, and we noticed all the guides were arriving at a particular time on the river to get the boats in and stuff. They all seemed to come at the same time, so we figured we'd outsmart the guides the next day. We went out earlier, you know, an hour earlier, where all the guides were there. Uh-huh. But you're out there fishing. We're not doing any good at all. And we go, what's the deal here? You know, I mean, yesterday it's fine, but now today it's no good. And then here come the guides, and the boats start coming in. Then everybody's catching fish, including us. And we learned that, you know, early is not always the best time to go. That the water, you know, the sun hadn't warmed the water up. The bugs weren't coming off, so the fish were just kind of hanging back. And as soon as the sun had started to warm the water up, the big bugs started coming off, then fish were on the bite. You know, it's pretty simple when you think about it, but at the time we were a little confused why we weren't into the fish, you know. So, you know, the guides knew what they were doing. There's no reason to get up super early when the fish aren't on, you know. So.
Well, now you know.
Yeah, now I know, yeah. So the next day we slept in. Well, Rick Takahashi, and Rick's been on our show and talking about midges. He's a midge expert, but he wrote in and asked a couple of questions. The first one is about what kind of fly rods and reels you like to use fishing lakes. Do you have a selection that you bring along, you know, and for what purposes?
Well, at a minimum, I'll have 4 fly rods with me. And one thing I like as a characteristic of all the rods, they're typically 9 feet long, good overall length. But I like rods that have a very light tip to them. And so whether it's a 3-weight rod or a 6-weight rod, I just like something with a very, very flexible and forgiving tip. The reason is, and I'll give you an example, this past week I was fishing at East Lake in Central Oregon. For those listeners that haven't fished it before, it's in the Newberry Crater. It's right next to Paulina Lake, and it's about, I'm going to make up a number here, 40 miles south of Bend. And I had to resort to a size 22 midge pupa, and I fished this on a 7X tippet, which tested about 2.5 pounds. And so I had to rely on a soft touch in setting the hook. First fish, broke it off clean. I reacted a little bit too heavily on the strike. It wasn't the fish, it was me there. So I made sure I kept my finger off of the reel, the reel handle, and relied on my drag setting to set the hook. But what saved me was the soft, flexible tip in the rod. So it cushioned, or it was acted like a shock absorber. So that's one thing I really like in a lake fishing fly rod, is a soft, flexible tip, no matter the line weight. As for reels, particularly where I'm dealing with big fish, I need to have a reel with a very sensitive drag setting, and it has to be reliable when it's wet. Like you mentioned earlier, out here in Oregon, especially in northwestern Oregon, we deal with the rain a lot. It's inevitable that the reel is going to get wet. So even some expensive reels I've had, when they get wet, either dunked or rained on, the drag can go to free spool, a flaw in the system. I can't have that, especially with big fish. You're going to get a reel overrun. So most often, and except when I'm stripping line, retrieving line, swimming the flies through the water, I leave my hand off the reel. No finger on the line. I'm not feathering the reel spool, nothing. I want the line to come straight off the reel to cushion the strike. And so a good disc drag that performs while it's wet, imperative to me. Once a fish is on, it's the drag in the reel and its performance that's going to win or lose the fish for me, it seems. As far as I'm big into fluorocarbon when it comes to leaders and tippets, just for the invisibility factor. And with second generation fluorocarbon now, you got the strength of just about any good material that's out there. So I kind of threw that in. I know Rick asked about rods and reels, but
I also
had to throw in the tippet material there.
Sure. Now, what about weight rods? And do you, when you say you have 4 different rods or 5, I can't remember what you said now, but
minimum of 4.
Weight. Yeah.
Well, give you an example on this last trip. I had rod weights. I actually had 6 rods with me in my boat. And they ranged line weight from 3 to 6. 6 is a little bit heavy for most of the fishing I do, but if I'm going to throw big flies, streamers, buggers, some sort, and I have to deal with the wind, and often that's a reality on a lake at some point in the day, the wind's going to come up, then I need something with a little extra punch, so 6 weight is there. But generally, 3, 4, and 5 weight rods work for me.
Okay, okay. We need to take a quick break here, Michael. When we come back, we'll dig more into fly fishing Stillwater, so hang tight. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut, fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Michael Gorman about effective stillwater fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight. Well, Michael, I always ask my guests what's going on in their fly fishing world at this point in the show. So what's happening with you, and share with us a bit about your business up there as well.
Well, it's a very busy time of year, Roger. Trying to work in my own fishing, as I did the last 4 days in Central Oregon, but also guiding. Spring through, pretty late into the summer, I'm guiding for trout, but eventually I'm going to move my operation on a temporary basis, as I do each year, down on Oregon's Rogue River, where I guide for steelhead. That's the single most popular venue that I have for my guided clients, and we chase big fish with skinny rods and hold on tight. So I'll do that into early December. Yeah, it sounds a little strange fishing for summer steelhead into December, but that's what we do. And then I transition into the winter fishing on the central and northern Oregon coast in pursuit of steelhead again. So it's just that time of year with not enough days in a week, too many places to fish, and not enough time to do it.
Now, you said you're working on a new book. You want to tell us about your new book and when it might be coming out?
Yes. I'm working with Frank Amato at Amato Books out of Portland, Oregon. And it's all things to do about nymph fishing. So not only nymph fishing for trout in streams, which most people are familiar with and can get their start, but I'm also talking about nymph fishing for steelhead, the challenges that are inherent in that fishery, and also specifically nymph fishing for stillwater fish, the trout and the char in lakes and ponds. So it's a misunderstood technique to a lot of people, quite mysterious, and so I'm going to try and answer some serious questions and give people my slant on how to effectively catch fish using nymphs in a variety of environments.
Great, great. And if people want to find out about your guide service and so forth, where can they find you?
I'd steer them to I have two websites. They can go to GormanFlyFishing.com or MackenzieRiverFlyFishing.com. Those are both my sites. As the name would imply, one is specifically about the Mackenzie River, but it makes reference to my other website, which is more general and is a more comprehensive view of what I do and what I teach and where I've been and who I am. And of course, all about my books, too.
Yeah, yeah, good, good. You want to repeat those two again for us?
It's Gorman, my last name, G-O-R-M-A-N, GormanFlyFishing.com, and MackenzieRiverFlyFishing.com.
Great, great. Thanks for sharing. Okay, let's dive back in here. Okay, we talked a little bit about equipment. What about other equipment like Are you normally on the still waters that you fish, fishing from shore or from some kind of flotation device, float tube, pontoon boat, or some other kind of boat? Which do you prefer?
Well, there aren't many waters that I've fished where you can successfully fish from the shore, at least for any extended period of time. In most situations, Roger, we've got vegetation, bushes, trees, all sorts of plants along the shoreline that will block you getting to the water. Secondly, even if you do get there, the water could drop into water that's pretty deep, maybe too deep to stand in. Or if the water is shallow, you may be all of a sudden up to your knees or your thighs in mud or silt to do it. So very few lakes, it seems, at least in my experience, lend themselves well to shore fishing. Much more easily done with a spinning rod than a fly rod, too. So the back cast is also a consideration. Two lakes in Oregon that can be successfully fished, and are quality lakes, successfully fished from the shore, just wading out. One is a lake that I just returned from, and that's East Lake. If anglers go over along the eastern shoreline there, it's very, very friendly wading, very fine pumice rock bottom. And this time of year, the fish, particularly early and mid-morning, will come into the shallows to feed on Calabatus mayflies. And so a short cast with a good fly and a little bit of stealth can produce some fish. And the other lake is in southeastern Oregon, and that's Mann Lake, M-A-N-N. And it's rare that I have ever taken a boat out on that lake because the perimeter all the way around the lake is fairly shallow and lends itself to wading. But other than that, I'm going to lose just about 100% of my fishing unless I've got a craft to get out onto the lake. So, you know, and somebody that's new to the game and doesn't know about watercraft, if you look around, you can get a float tube and a set of fins for less than $100, which is pretty reasonable. You know, some retailers, you can find those things on sale or on the Internet. You get a lot of possibilities, too. So the point is you can get set up pretty inexpensively and get out onto a lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's not necessarily to get out in the middle of the lake, but more to be able to work the shoreline, correct?
Yes. In most cases, that's where the fishable water is going to be. And when the wind comes up, you'll appreciate the fact you're not out in the middle of the lake, too, especially if you're in a little craft and only have fins to propel yourself.
Right, right. So is there anything that you prefer, a float tube over a pontoon boat or other kind of boat?
Well, it depends on the situation, and that's a good question. I have several float tubes, and in certain situations, let's say I'm going to be hiking into a lake. I got to carry all my gear. It's the only feasible way to go. Or, for instance, I'm flying to Argentina, which I have done, and do some lake fishing there from the standpoint of reasonable transport. Taking a float tube in the deflated form is really the way to go. Most of my fishing is done with a little pontoon boat. I have a little hard shell pontoon boat that I can not only propel with my fins, but also it has rowing capabilities. So I can cover a lot of distance if I need to. It's only 75 inches long. And like I said, it's a hard shell boat. It's made by Hobie. I don't know that they make them anymore. They make the big pontoon boats that people are familiar with, Hobie Craft. But if you can find one of these, the thing I like about it is I don't have to repair the pontoons. They never deflate. They're always inflated when I get to the lake. I just throw it in and go. It's kind of a lazy man's craft. And I also have a drift boat, which I use on my guiding tours on the rivers. So it's meant for negotiating whitewater. But it's also a good craft and a stable platform to cast from, especially when I have beginners. And I want them right next to me. And I'm going to coach them on casting and techniques and all. And they don't have to have any wading equipment. They don't have to worry about safety or getting wet. And so I'll often rely on that. So the kind of the long answer is, you know, it depends on the situation, and I have a number of craft to choose from, and those are the three, either the float tube, the pontoon boat, or my drift boat that I use.
Okay. Let's talk about food and flies still water. What are some of the major insects, and I'm sure there's a lot of minor ones that, that can come into play, but what are the major insects that we should be concerned with on still water and be prepared to fish with?
Okay. Well, at the top of my list, and I devoted two chapters to chironomids, so that's the fly fishing term, midges. They're number one and extremely important year-round because that's sometimes all the fish have to feed on. In the winter months, early spring, the chironomids are very, very important and available to the fish year-round. Very hardy, very wide distribution, and very important. So it's at the top of my list. But there are times, depending on the season of the year and the particular lake being fished, that other things will become more important, or at least as important as chironomids. For instance, June and July, in my part of the world, Calabatus mayflies are very prevalent. And in fact, the last 4 days I was out fishing here just recently, the focus was on fishing the Calabatus nymphs as they swam to the surface and emerged into the adult form, and then at certain times of day, fishing the adult Calabatus. Calabatus is a genus of mayflies in the family Betidae, and they are, as far as mayflies go, for the longest duration in the spring and early summer season, a very, very important mayfly. So when you hear people reference, you know, fishing mayflies this time of year, you know, chances are 9 out of 10, that's the specific mayfly they're going to be talking about. Also in the mix here, we have damselflies. Saw a lot of damsels cruising along. For those people that may not be familiar with damselflies, they look like a skinny dragonfly. Out here in the West, the predominant color of these skinny dragonflies, actually damselflies, is sky blue with black banding. One easy way to distinguish the damselfly from the dragonflies, and the dragonflies have their place too. You always want to have dragonflies in your fly box selection. Imitations of the nymphs, anyway, but the damselflies can be told. Lost my word here. Anyway, they can be distinguished from the dragonflies by the orientation of their wings. When you see a damselfly at rest, its wings are held over its back, whereas everybody knows with the dragonfly they're held out at right angles to the body, like little biplane wings. But dragonflies are important, especially during the dragonfly nymph migration. Caddisflies can be important depending on the lake. And then there are some non-insect things that are also important. But those are the big ones. So in review, we got the chironomids, we got the Calabatus mayflies, the damselflies, and the dragonflies, and the caddis in the mix too. So those are kind of the big ones. There are other peripheral players, but you got to have imitations of those in your box.
And when you're talking about damsel and dragon, are you primarily fishing the nymph stage of those rather than adults? Or?
Yes. During the migration, they're pretty easy for the fish to intercept. And they have a very distinctive fishing movement. I'll talk about that a little bit later, I think. And you want to imitate their distinctive swimming motion if you want to effectively fish those flies. Because they're very good flyers, the dragonflies in particular, in the adult stage, are very difficult for the fish to apprehend. They're just too quick. And so I think the fish quickly learn that it's a waste of their time if they see a dragonfly buzzing around and they can see all directions at once with their multifaceted eyes. Very difficult to catch. When the damselflies return to the lake surface to deposit the eggs, there are times that they may get stuck just for a moment and buzzing and flapping in the surface, and the fish will be able to apprehend those. And there are times that, you know, when the female is done, she is spent, she's on the water for the last time, you know, her wings are vibrating and she'll be sitting there and she'll be trout food for some nearby fish. Dragonflies, not so much. But yes, primarily, you're correct, Roger, it's the nymphoform that we want to imitate when fishing the damselflies and the dragonflies.
So You had mentioned just a minute ago about certain techniques of fishing. I think you're referring to the damsels or dragon nymphs. Could you describe some of those, give us some tips on that, and, you know, any of the other insects that you might fish a bit differently than you would in a stream?
Sure.
And maybe we can talk about chironomids a little later, because I think there was a couple of questions on chironomids a little later.
All right. I'll save the chironomids then.
Okay.
But if you've done much lake or pond fishing in the spring, early summer, sooner or later you're going to see swimming damsel nymphs. They're a long, slender nymph, usually a shade of tan, olive, or even bright green sometimes, depending on their environment. They want to be camouflaged in the area in which they live. But they have this very distinctive side-to-side, this lateral wiggling of the body. And it's a very beautiful flowing movement. And typically what they'll do is sideways wiggle, 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 and then they'll pause. And then they'll resume their wiggle, wiggle movement. So in fishing the damsel, it's hard to make your fly, even by moving your rod tip laterally, to make it move lateral. So the best we can do are these kind of smooth, medium, quick, short pulls. I'm talking just a couple inches, interspersed with pauses. So I might make three or four short, little quick strips, and then pause it for a count of three, and then resume the short little strips. Dragonflies, on the other hand, they swim by means of jet propulsion. So they actually swell their abdomen to take in water. They have actually have rectal gills. And so they're multitasking. As they take in water, the oxygenated water flows over their internal gills, and then as they expel it, it does the same thing and moves them forward. So they take the water in and they squirt it out. And they can do it pretty quickly. If anybody goes to YouTube and looks up something like swimming dragonfly nymph, something to that effect, they're going to find that. I've seen a couple of videos out there that somebody has made. So you can actually look at the swimming movement, know what the fish are used to seeing, and then imitate that. So the pulls are fairly quick, a little bit longer, and in some cases more sustained. For instance, I might pull five or six fairly short, quick strips before pausing, and then repeat the thing. So that kind of movement is pivotal in knowing how to fish it. So if somebody, for instance, was going to fish a dragonfly nymph or a damselfly nymph on a straight troll, and I'll get into what trolling is. Trolling is just pulling the fly behind your watercraft. And you can mix it up, you can vary the speed, you can actually stop it. But too many people just have a smooth, continuous movement of the fly. So nothing variable about it, no pauses. So that can be ineffective when it comes to fishing dragonfly nymphs and damsel nymphs, because that isn't what the fish are used to seeing them.
What about direction? Normally those nymphs are moving toward shore, correct?
Yes, good point.
So when you're... Good point. When you're out in your float tube, how do you do it more laterally against the shore, or how do you work that?
Well, you know, almost directly at the shoreline works. If you're out in the middle of the lake, of course, quite away from the shore, you can fish them in any direction. But you raise an excellent point. If it's near a shoreline, it's certainly best to move the fly in the direction of the shoreline. So you could park your floating craft if you're going to cast and retrieve them, you know, with your back to the shore, cast out and retrieve it towards the shore. And it's little things like that, little details that can make the difference. So you can have the right fly pattern, the right fly line, you can be fishing it in the right way, but the direction, you know, might enable you to fool one more fish or a few more fish or that big fish just by making that correction. So excellent point.
What about some of the other food sources on the lake? What are, again, the primary ones that we might be concerned with that are not, you know, insects?
Yeah, scuds are very important. Some people refer to them as freshwater shrimp. They can be extremely important in some lakes. So you want imitations of those, and they also have kind of a distinctive swimming movement. So, again, short strips, You don't want to overdo it on the speed in many cases. I think slower is better than faster. But it's often like us running a sprint. We run a little ways and then we rest. We run a little ways and then we rest. And so the pauses and sometimes just coming to a complete stop and letting the fly sink can be all the difference to certain fish. In addition to the scuds, leeches, extremely important. You know, kind of creepy creatures to us, but fish love them. And they'll come a long ways to eat a leech. Many of the fly patterns that I carry are leechy type patterns. And in fact, most of my fly box space, because in some cases they can be quite large, is dedicated to leech patterns. And you've got all sorts of styles and materials and sizes and ways to fish them. So extremely important. And it seems that if people get into lake fishing, the one lake fly they've ever heard about is a woolly bugger.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And
easy to tie when you're yeah. getting started, too.
Easy to tie, easy to fish, and the fish absolutely love them. And then, you know, there are also small fish that are going to be dining fare for trout and char, especially the bigger ones. And those are the ones that most people are interested in catching, it seems. So having bait fish imitations or just small fish, even if they're small trout or small char, important. So those three in particular, very important non-insect things, not the only ones, but three of the big ones.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Michael, we've got to take another quick break, and we'll be right back and talk more about the flies in your box. How's that? Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Michael Gorman about effective stillwater fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Michael, Joe in Arvada, Colorado, wrote in and asked, how many different flies do you carry? And he says, well, not how many of each fly, but how many different flies do you have in your box?
Well, I'm almost embarrassed to tell you. First of all, let me say that when I'm guiding on streams, trout and steelhead, you know, I might have two fly boxes with me. But when I go lake fishing, I've got an athletic duffel bag that you could put a good-sized dog in, and it's full of fly boxes, all for lakes. So I've got a very large fly box that's dedicated just to black leech patterns. I've got one that's just olive leeches, brown leeches. You get the idea. Then I've got my calabatus fly box. I've got my dries and emergers in multiple boxes. And I probably have six boxes with chironomids in them. So, you know, to answer Joe's question about how many different flies, well, you know, I could probably start counting tonight, maybe finish up by tomorrow night to find out how many different things. And when I walk into a fly shop and I always look at the flies and I always have to buy something. And if I see intriguing stillwater patterns, you know, it just adds to my collection. And, you know, 3 years later I remembered, oh, yeah, I'll have to try that fly. And being a fly tire, I'm always trying to experiment with things. So, you know, Joe, I would be surprised if I did not have 1,000 different flies in my stillwater fishing collection.
Yeah. You know, I was expecting you to say just the opposite. I was expecting that you'd have more flies for river fishing and less flies for stillwater. But see, what do I know? Joe also mentioned Denny Rickard's seal bugger, and we've had Denny on the show talking about stillwater fishing as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, another Oregon boy.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I've used that seal bugger, too. That seems to be a pretty darn good fly. in a lot of movement and stuff. Have you used that or something similar to that that you use?
Yes, I do. I have some of Denny Rickard's seal buggers in a variety of colors. I've got brown and black and shades of olive and some of his other patterns, too. Yeah, it's a very good fly. You know, the way it's tied, and I think one of the keys to the fly, besides, you know, the halo effect in the seal-like fur used on the body, is the attention to the particular type of marabou, the character of the marabou used in the tail. That's really a big thing. All marabou isn't created equal. So what I'm saying is, in Denny's seal bugger, he's got a lot of movement, a lot of, hey, look at me, I'm alive, come and eat me,
right,
sort of
right.
appearance in the fly.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
So highly recommend it. It's a good one.
Rick Takahashi, another question about what are your favorite patterns to fish with regards to Calabatus, damsel, scud, midges, beetles, forage fish. Do you have any particular patterns that you prefer over others?
I do. So I'll just kind of take them one at a time here. We'll start with the Calabatus. It's hard for me to pick just one, so I'm going to pick several. And I'll tell you why it's important to have several. Fishing East Lake just recently, I'm going to harken back to that again because it was Calabatus time, and that's specifically why I go there in late June, early July. And one of my favorite patterns is one called the Poxyback Calabatus Nymph. It's kind of a medium brown, and it's got a bead of epoxy on the wing case, and it's caught a lot of fish for me. But the reason I say you got to have more than one is in 3 days in fishing East Lake, I could not catch a fish on it, even though the Calabatus were there. And so I went to some of my other flies, and the Calabatus Nymph that worked best for me was a variation of an old standby. It was the Flashback Pheasant Tail Nymph in a size 14, and the fish were hard and selective for that particular pattern, at least on this trip. You know, I've used very generalized things like Calbird's Bird's Nest in a medium brown. That's a very excellent one for me, too. And a Flashback Hare's Ear, especially in a, you know, kind of a medium brown color. So there's four possibilities for the Calabatus, not all, but four that I use on a regular basis.
Isn't it funny how, not funny, it's just, but interesting how that pheasant tail and hare's ear always, yeah. You know, I mean, those are probably one of the first two nymphs I ever learned in fly fishing, and they're as good as they were, you know, 40 years ago, you know, so, or longer.
Yes, they just have that buggy look
yeah.
to them, you know, and, you know, the hare's ear has stood the test of time. You know, it traces its lineage back more than 150 years.
Is it really? Yeah.
Yeah, it's been around a long time. As for damsel nymphs, in my book I talk about my goat damsel, so it's actually Angora goat fur. Pretty buggy, pretty simple. Most important thing I can tell anybody about the damsel nymphs is keep them slender. The thinner, the better, it seems. And then there's also my book, you see something called the two-tone damsel. I've also heard it called the no-name damsel, put out by Umpqua Feather Merchants. And it's basically a fly where the body and tail are made out of marabou, and it's a tan or golden or brown marabou over a shade of olive. And it has little plastic bead chain eyes on it. Very realistic looking fly. Catches a lot of fish. Scuds, a couple. One I refer to as the MCU scud, which is the most commonly used. So you can imagine a shade of olive, typically, fur on a hook, and over the top of that, the shell back, you can use a material called scud back. You can use plastic from a plastic bag if you wanted to, and I have, or you can use a strip of pearlescent mylar tinsel. But pretty simple pattern. One thing that will enhance it is if you're a fly tier, put a dot of orange dubbing in it. There are pregnant scuds that have a little orange dot, and sometimes there can be a little parasite, as I recall, that will also turn it orange. So sometimes a little thing like that can trigger a strike. I also have something called a hair sked. So I use a hare's mask or hare's ear, and you can get it in a variety of colors. I like shades of brown and olive in that, and put the same sort of shell back over it and rib it with wire. So pretty simple pattern there for the scuds. As far as midges, wow. That's why I carry 6 or 7 midge boxes, is because it's hard to come up with just one, but I certainly want to imitate 3 stages of the 4 life stages of the midge. So I've got larval imitations, which are essentially just plastic ribbing or V-rib. It goes by a variety of names, wrapped on a hook, keep it slender and small. Colors like red, olive, tan, brown. And then the midge pupae. It's the pupa that most flanglers associate with coronamid fishing, and all sorts of possibilities there. But basically what you've got is a slender body with a wire rib and a thorax and a head on it. The mix and match color combinations and the materials you use for them are almost endless. I wrote an article recently to be coming out soon in one of our Northwest magazines, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, on something called the gill hat coronamid. Tying these with my sister, she said in tying the gill filaments at the top of the fly, she said it looked like it had a gill hat. So the name kind of stuck. But I think in many situations, imitating the little white gill filaments at the head of the coronamid pupa can be important. All sorts of colors of beads and sizes, and so, but the basic pattern, I mean, is fairly universal. Slender body, wire rib, thorax and head, maybe put on those gill filaments at the top using white antron. And let's see, there's one other fly here, beetles. You know, a simple little foam beetle is as good as anything. I want something that can float high and foam, you know, similar to what you see in the Chernobyl ants and its variations. Pretty simple, pretty effective. You can put some slender little rubber legs out to the side on them. I like to fish a pattern that has a little of brightly colored foam, so it can be orange, it can be green, it can be white, so I can see that dark little fly sitting on the water. The fish won't see it necessarily, but enables me to see it. So just a simple little beetle pattern made out of foam is what I need. As far as forage fish goes, it's hard to beat a zonker. So a zonker, for those that may not know, is a fly typically with a mylar body of some sort, mylar tubing. You can get it in silver, you can get it in gold, you can get it in pearl, you can get it in black, variety of things. And then it has a topping or an overwing of a rabbit strip. And again, you can get any color, shade of rabbit strip you want to match the bait fish. So simple fly, flashy body, can be flattened, so it has a fairly broad profile, and then topped with a rabbit fur wing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good, good. A lot of good suggestions there. Okay, Joan in Seattle wrote, Michael, in your book you made mention of the importance of having a strategic game plan for fly fishing. Is there a simple way to develop such a strategic plan for fishing a lake that I'm not familiar with? And yeah, there was somebody else that had asked that same question. It's a common, you know, new water, where do I begin?
Okay. Well, the answer would be fairly simple, but it's very, very involved. I'll put it that way, because there are a lot of components to it. If you want to do it right, you know, one of the things that we as human beings tend to fight sometimes is being lazy and not doing the homework. And so I try to make it a fact to remind myself not to be lazy as I go through all this. So before I go fishing, okay, I've got to begin my research. And, you know, what we've had in the last 15 years, 20 years is the Internet. And what a great resource. It really shortcuts the system as far as research goes. So that's where I start, typically, Roger. I'll go to the Internet, and the first thing I look for is a fishing report. So, you know, if I hear about ABC Lake in British Columbia and I want to fish it, I'm just going to do a search and see if anybody wants to talk about it out there. And there are some good websites that will specifically, you know, solicit fishing reports so you can find out about what's going on. So somehow this is how I get lake ideas, and then I'll research it. Or sometimes this is how I'll find a lake, is to say, hey, I'm going to be up in eastern Washington for the weekend, and I want to go lake fishing. What's out there? So internet research, that's where I'm going to go, and a fishing report is really important. If I can go to YouTube and find somebody that wants to show me the lake and what they're doing and how they're fishing, sometimes that can be an excellent resource. If I hear a reference to a fly pattern that I've never heard of, then I'll go to Google Images and put it in. I'll put in fly fishing in the fly name and see what it looks like. And that can be good, especially if there are very localized patterns that aren't popularly known. Sometimes you can find them out there. One of the other things that I'm looking at in the fishing report or YouTube, actually watching somebody fish, is where are they fishing on the lake? So are they near a resort? Are they near a landmark that I can tell? Are they near a boat launch? Will they mention that? So that's also important information, not just what flies are they using and how are they using, but where are they fishing? And also I can then get some clues as to what kind of equipment that I'll need to take. I have a lot of things to choose from, especially fly lines, and so I want to make sure I have the right things when I go up there. Then there are other resources besides the internet. As I, again, prepare my strategic game plan here, books and magazines. There are a lot of good books on stillwater fishing or magazine articles that I've read about over the years, and I want to bring those to bear, especially if they talk about the specific lake or lakes I'm going to be fishing. And lastly, personal contacts. I have a lot of contacts, having been in retail and taught classes for 27 years. I'm in contact with a lot of people. So if I'm going to a lake that I haven't fished before, if I know of somebody or put the word out to my network that I'm going to be fishing a lake and what do you know about it and what can you tell, that's very, very useful. So it's those resources I do as I begin my homework. In all of these, I will create a file folder with documents in it. And that's what I carry with me. So if I do my research, then I'll cut or copy and paste things that I read about, put them in a document, print it out, take it with me. In addition to that file folder, I'll have maps. Well, one other important thing I'll find on the internet, possibly, is a bathymetric map showing the underwater contours, the depth, if you will, of the lake. And so bathymetric maps are very, very important in knowing where to fish if I don't have a clue on the lake. It shows me where the shallows are, it shows me where the depths are. It might show me where inlets are and springs, important things like that. And so I got my file folder going, and I've got other information there, non-fishing thing, about where I'm going to stay, who I'm going to contact, where I can get supplies, and where I'm going to go. Another very important thing in being prepared, part of my game plan is my checklist. What are the things I'm going to forget? And I'm going to forget things like spare batteries for my electronics. I'm going to forget them for my camera. I'm going to forget them for my depth finder, fish locator. I'm going to forget my stomach pump, which is a really key piece of equipment in helping me discern what the fish are eating. And then simple things like insect repellent, bug screen. All right. Another important thing I have to consider, especially when I'm fishing with other people, and I do this in all my guiding, but for my own fishing too, I have to try and determine in my game plan what can go wrong. What if the fishing is poor? Where do I go? What's nearby? What will I need if I go there? I have to stay on top of the weather. A little thing that I kind of ignored and shouldn't have at my own peril this last trip was the phase of the moon. And you mentioned Denny Rickards in his book, and Denny's big into phases of the moon. And thing that we look to avoid as best we can is the full moon or the phases of the moon near full. And had to contend with that. And I always wonder when the moon is fairly full how that affected the fishing, especially if it's been challenging. Equipment that can go down. People that only have one or two rods on a trip, they could be in peril if they break a rod. So got prepared for that possibility. So I remind myself of that. And the other thing that can go wrong is whoever I'm fishing with, they might forget something or their equipment might go down, and I'll have to help them out. So what do I have to do? All right, so that's before I get to the lake. This is a long-winded answer to your question. Oh, my gosh.
I'm already tired, Michael.
So I'd like to come up for air here. Okay. And then the next part of the game plan has to do with once I'm at the lake. So I do visual scouting, and I troll. You know, once I determine where I'm going to go, and that can be steered by, you know, rising fish that I see over there or that cluster of anglers, what's going on, and they're catching another fish. But to get from point A to point B, as I get onto the lake, I'm going to troll. So I'm just going to let out some line behind my little craft, whatever I'm propelling that day, and I'm going to be fishing, and I don't need to pay attention to it other than hold on to my rod. So I can be looking at my electronics. I can be looking for rising fish. I can be looking for insects on the water. I can be looking at other fishermen catching fish. So I'm fishing and learning at the same time. And even in my little boats, even in my float tube, I've got a minimum of 4 rods with me. That's part of my game plan. And if I'm with companions, you know, I want to stay in communication with them. One of the ways I can do that is with a two-way radio. Sometimes your cell phone will work on a lake. A lot of times it won't, especially here in mountainous areas. But that instant communications, or, you know, I have to track them down, or we have to get close enough that we can talk. But that's part of the game plan, too, is comparing notes. And then, depending on how it goes, I'm making adjustments throughout the day, and I'm prepared to do that with my flies, a variety of rods. I'm going to experiment with techniques. And then one other important conclusion to the game plan is my journaling and writing down about the day's events, especially if the fishing was difficult. So I can reflect on what happened, what I did, what I didn't do, and what I need to do next time. And if that's tomorrow, then I have to be prepared for that. So journaling is a very, very important thing for me in making sure, as I did on Roche Lake, referenced early in the show up in British Columbia, that, you know, I finally figured out. But I've got to remember what I did and what I didn't do as part of that game plan. Whew, I'm out of breath. Yeah. There's your long answer.
Sounds like more like NFL football preparation. That's why they watch all those, you know, the film and so forth.
Absolutely.
Up. And what you're saying is, hey, if you want to really be successful, fly fishing is no different than anything else that that you want to win at. And there certainly is thorough preparation that you talked about. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's try to knock out, we got a bunch more questions here, so let's try to knock out a lot of these. A lot of these are strategy and tactic questions here, so
okay.
Some will be short, some will be longer, I think. But DB in San Diego says, is fishing a lake during the middle of the day mostly an act of futility?
No, not always. And, you know, in large part, it depends on the time of the year. Middle of the day. For instance, I'll start my fishing in late winter, late February sometimes, depending on the weather conditions. And the water can be quite cold, and the best fishing of the day will be midday after the water has warmed up a degree or two, and the fish and the insects have gotten responsive. Same thing in the fall. You know, midday will be the warmest part of the day, and that's the time to go. Dead of summer, you know, I can see problems there, especially if there isn't a wind. You can find some factors like no wind, the lake is flat, the sun is high, the water is warm, the insects aren't hatching. That can be a tough time. It's time to go take a nap at that point. But just recently, in fact, on Sunday when I was fishing East Lake, got out onto the lake by about 8:30 in the morning, catching a few fish, but the fishing got better at midday, starting about 11:30 until 1 o'clock. The fishing was much better, and one of the factors that influenced that was that the clouds came in and the wind picked up a little bit to ripple the lake's surface, and so fishing got better. So it depends on the conditions to answer DB's question here about midday fishing.
Okay.
It depends on the conditions and the time of year.
Yeah. Randall in Phoenix wrote in and he says, Michael, I typically fish spring through fall in a couple of high elevation lakes in northern Arizona stocked with rainbows, but some are multi-year holdovers. When there is cloud cover or low light, morning better than evening, there is great surface activity and dries work great. However, in the midday, when I'm typically permitted to fish, the action is slower. I don't know what he means by permitted.
Maybe his fishing companion lets him go fishing at that time.
Yeah, his fishing companion or non-fishing companion lets him go. I don't know. Better straighten that out, Randall. Anyway, he says, you know, the fishing action is slower in the midday. Streamers and buggers can work, but hits are few and far between. Any tips for maximizing the Spartan time of day? He's having trouble with that midday, too.
Yeah, well, here's my number one plan. Fishing gets tough. I'm pulling out my stomach pump on the next fish I catch. Mm-hmm. Now, for those that may not be familiar with a stomach pump, it's a simple little apparatus. It looks like a miniature turkey baster. So you got a little plastic tube or barrel on it, and then a round bulb, rubber bulb that you can depress. So you squeeze the bulb, you stick it in the water, you can suck water into the bulb, that sort of thing. Okay, so I catch a fish, fishing's tough. I want to find out if there's something the fish are eating currently that I'm not fishing. So it's all contingent upon catching that first fish. And if people try this, I'm recommending that the fish be at least 10 inches long. If it's smaller than that, there's a chance that you can injure the fish by inserting this little plastic tube into its gullet, and its gullet be too small to accommodate it. So 10 inches is my cutoff for that. But you can extract either from its throat or from its stomach. What I do is inject a little water into the fish so it mixes, creates a slurry with whatever the fish has consumed, and then I draw it back into the little plastic bulb when I relax it. Let the fish go. And by the way, one other little tip. If you turn the fish over on its back so its belly is to the sky, the fish doesn't struggle as much. It seems to relax a little bit, so you can, you know, make quick work of extracting what the fish may have eaten. But then examining the stomach contents, you may be surprised. He's talking about using buggers and leeches, but they may be very well on dining on chironomids or some other little insect or scuds that he may not be aware of. So that's my first suggestion, is if you can catch that fish Randall indicated that he can catch a few, well, pump its stomach and check it out for what it might be eating.
Okay.
And then maybe make an adjustment on the flies and the technique to do that. The other possibility is I'd recommend that he consider indicator fishing. We haven't talked about that, but using a little float under which you suspend chironomid pupae, which are everywhere. They are in lakes in Arizona and Argentina and Alaska, wherever you may be fishing for them. And consider that as a technique. It's a very simple one. You cast it out, try and suspend the fly off the bottom. You need to know the depth or experiment to discover it. And just let the fish come to the fly.
Stephen in Brunswick, Ohio, asked about that. He says, do you ever use a strike indicator when fishing still water? He says, my choice is Floatmaster products indicators because of its simplicity. Mm-hmm. What are you using for indicators? And is it different for, I'm assuming when you're talking about, as you just did about indicator fishing, you're probably using chironomids more than anything else?
Yeah, not solely chironomids, but certainly the majority of the times it's chironomids. As far as indicators, everybody has their favorite. I use a couple. Thingamabobbers. That's the name of them, thingamabobbers. I hope they appreciate that plug. But
yeah,
they come in force.
A lot of people use those. Those have come up.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very, very popular. I use them for stream fishing. They're flawless in their performance. They just float. That's all I ask. But I use the smallest size thingamabobber. So it's the size let's say, somebody's little fingernail. Not very big, so they're easy to cast. They float. They come in high visibility colors. And then I use a slip strike foam indicator with an insert in it. And they're necessary to use when you're fishing long leaders. For instance, on Roche Lake, I was fishing in 20 feet of water, so I had 19 feet between my indicator and my fly, and there's no way that you can reel in a fish if that indicator is fixed. So these simple painted foam, dense foam indicators with a little peg in them, slip strike indicators. Those are the two that I use, but there are certainly other things out there to use. But I use an indicator a lot.
Okay. Scott in Portland, Oregon asked, are there any effective methods or patterns of fishing stillwater when it is turning over in the spring and the fall? And we've talked about lake turnover in other shows, but maybe you want to just mention real quickly what that is, and is that a time to fish or just let the lake be?
Well,
situation.
You never know unless you try, sort of thing. So lake turnover typically happens in the spring and in the fall. And at ice out for those lakes that freeze, and even those that don't, typically the surface waters in a normal condition, like this time of year, the warmest water is going to be at the top, and the coolest, coldest water is going to be to the bottom. But at ice out in the springtime, and I'll use that as an example here, as the ice thaws and the water warms a bit, it's going to eventually descend and replace the surface water is the water at the bottom. So it's this big circular movement as the surface waters. And by the way, surface water, it's kind of interesting, is densest at 39 degrees. So it isn't 32 because ice floats. But as it warms up a bit, it actually gets denser. And at 39 degrees, that water will be denser, heavier, if you will, and it will sink through the water column. So these big convection cells set up as the surface water descends and the water from the lake bottom ascends towards the surface. And that can last, let's say, up to a week. The problem for the fish, besides the clarity of the water, which can be quite cloudy, murky at that time, is that there's a decrease in the overall dissolved oxygen content. Along the lake bottom, especially in the wintertime, you have decomposing vegetation there. And so it uses up the available oxygen in that process. So the fish tend to hang a little bit higher because of the depleted oxygen. The surface waters have more oxygen in them. So as the water is mixed, the oxygen in the upper surface water is diluted by mixing with the water that it's replacing along the bottom. So you have a overall decrease in the dissolved oxygen. This stresses the fish. So my suggestion is that Scott look for areas where you have highly oxygenated water, if available. As an example, if you have an inlet stream, it can introduce oxygenated water, and the fish can collect there. If you have shallow areas that are windswept, just the little wave action and the mixing caused by the waves will introduce more oxygen into the water. So those are a couple of places that I would look for fish if I'm going to fish at turnover time. As far as fly patterns, you know, I don't have any specific recommendations. When I go on a search, if I'm in that situation, I'm going to have two flies on my line. Where it's legal, I'm always fishing multiple flies. And I'm fishing about 30 inches apart. And my top two choices for my searching flies would be a size 8 midnight woolly bugger. So the midnight is a chenille that has black mixed with a little red and a little blue. So a size 8 pattern there and a size 12 beadhead prince. And I've got them separated by 25 to 30 inches, and I'm going to cast those into the likely-looking spots at turnover time, the places that I mentioned, and mix up the retrieves and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, good. Good advice. A couple others here. One, I wanted to make sure that we still got a bunch that were sent in advance, so I'm going to try to cover these first before anything online. Davey Wanton in Arkansas, and Davey's been on our show several times, and he was formerly from Wales in the UK. He says, traditional style wet fly fishing has historically been the mainstay for stillwater fly fishing in the UK, until the early 1900s when Dr. Bell first introduced the Bell's Buzzer, an imitation of the Chronomid, which has very much changed the approach that fly fishers took so far as a more direct approach to represent natural food sources with nymphing techniques. That said, traditional wet fly fishing is still widely practiced and will many times way outfish other methods. Do you practice wet fly fishing, Michael, or do you have any idea of its value for fishing still waters. I ask the question, as I know of very few anglers who know how to fish these techniques.
Well, you know, I look at flies like the woolly bugger as a wet fly. You know, maybe the more traditional thing would be a zonker or some kind of swimming insect with a, you know, a feather wing laid back over the body sort of thing. So I guess in Davey's question, I think I fish wet flies a lot, and what he means by traditional methods, I don't know. I fish them in a variety of ways. I'll cast and retrieve them, make them swim through the water like they're imitating a swimming organism. I will certainly troll them, and there are so many variations on the retrieve combined with the troll that I think I'm fishing wet flies a lot, but again, I'm not too sure of Davey's definition of the traditional way to fish
wet flies. Yeah, I think
wet flies.
What Davey's talking about, and as far as stream fishing goes with wet flies, are more along the lines of soft hackle flies, mm-hmm. fished in a, you know, a lot of times in a swing or a swimming action in streams, which you don't, you know, you don't have that action particularly in the lake unless you're creating it. So when he's talking about wet flies, I don't think he's talking about streamers or woolly buggers. He's talking more insect, you know, imitations there. So.
Well, you know, the closest that I would have, I do use pheasant tail soft tackles. They're excellent, especially when mayflies and caddis are emerging on lakes. The one chance that I would get to fish them kind of in a traditional way would be at a stream inlet as it comes into a lake. And I remember in Argentina doing specifically that, swimming flies across the current as it entered the lake, and then, you know, stripping it back once it came out of the current in the lake. You know, because I've got moving water there as it enters the lake, I guess that's about as close as I could get to more of the traditional down and across, let it swing and swim it back sort of wet fly tradition.
Couple more questions, and I'm gonna. I know we're running over time here, but I want to try to get these questions in the people. If you're game, Michael, I'm trying to knock a few of these more out. Mark in New Zealand wrote. He says, for figuring out depth, we can count down the line sink rate. But if you put a tungsten bead, say 3.3 or 3.8 on the end, how do you allow for that as well as the line sink rate, or is the line heavier than?
Yeah, you know, I can't figure a good way other than by trial and error, the countdown method. Certainly the tungsten bead is going to affect it, and the line I use. It is important to know the depth of the water that I'm fishing, and I have electronics for that. For somebody that wanted to know the exact depth, if that helped them, you know, fish their flies, whether they're weightless or have beads on them. A simple way, if you don't have the electronics, is to take something that you probably have on your vest, a forceps, and you can lock it. You can lock the jaws right on your fly if you want, and then just let line out. Because it's heavier than a little tiny, you know, fly, even with a tungsten bead, I can't quite tell, you know, when that bead is finally sunk into the mud, other than to retrieve it back and see something hanging on it. But with the, you know, locking your forceps on your fly, dropping it overboard, and then seeing how much line was extended beyond your rod tip, that way I can get the depth. I don't know if I'm answering the question here that he's asking.
I think he's more asking about the sink rate of, like, using sinking or maybe intermediate line to try to know what depth you're at when, you know, retrieving.
Yeah, you know, that's why I carry multiple lines. The lines I always have on board with me, at a bare minimum, I'm going to have my floating line so I can either fish dry or I'm going to be fishing an indicator and suspending a fly underneath it. I'm going to have my intermediate line, typically clear colored, and it has a sink rate of maybe 3/4 to 1.5 inches per second. I'm going to carry a type 3 line, and it has to be density compensated. That's an important element of a, you know, the more standard faster sinking lines, that they be density compensated so that they sink in a straight line. The old lines, let's say pre-1980s, without the density compensation tended to sink in a kind of a U configuration. So you had the belly of the line sunk and you had the fly up above it, and then it comes up to your rod tip. So, you know, in fishing sinking lines, make sure they're density compensated as best you can. And a variety of manufacturers make those. And I'm also going to have a clear sinking tip, either 10 feet or 15 feet, with the balance of the line floating. So back to fishing at specific depths, these four lines are going to enable me to fish a variety of depths and very effectively. So if I'm on the bottom and stuck in vegetation all the time, I'm going to a different line. If I'm never getting down and I'm not catching fish, then I'm going to the other sinking line. And it can change through my day. All of a sudden, I'm fishing 5 feet of water where I was out in 20 before. So I need to switch lines. I may still have to get the fly down, but, you know, and I can make an adjustment with the type of fly, but, you know, in some situations, I don't want to bead on my fly because my fly line can be suspended up where it needs to be in an efficient zone, but the bead's going to carry that fly right down into the vegetation or the mud, and I'm out of the game.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see what we talked about. A couple of questions came in about chironomid techniques and how you rig up for chironomids in still water. Can you address that as briefly as you can, and then we'll call it a night?
Sure. Okay. Two techniques that I employ. One is suspending a chironomid pupa or a chironomid larva underneath an indicator. Very simple technique. Need to know the water depth. So my electronics, or if I forgot my batteries, I'm going to clip my forceps on my line, and I'm going to find out the depth. I want to suspend that fly about a foot off the bottom. Sometimes the fish will respond if I, you know, after I've let it sit for a minute, nothing happens. If I slowly move my indicator to me a foot and let that fly kind of readjust, sometimes that will trigger strike. Pretty simple, very effective method. Got to have it. The other is something that came out of British Columbia, and I've used and I enjoy when I want to be more proactive in my chironomid fishing, and that's called fishing naked. And naked just refers not to my clothes, but to the fact that I'm not using a strike indicator. It starts with a leader. You're going to use a floating fly line, and a leader that is about 25% longer than the water depth that you're fishing. So I'll use as an example 20 feet of water. I'm going to need a leader that is 25 feet long, so 20 plus 25% more, 25 feet long. And you're going to cast the fly out. You're going to be patient, let it sink. And how far do you need to let it sink? You know, it depends on the water depth, whether the fly has a bead on it or not. And then you're just going to very slowly, essentially all you're doing is keeping the line tight. I use a slow hand twist retrieve. And once that fly is near the bottom, I just inch it back ever so painfully in my direction. But you're going to feel the strike, and again, you're going to feel a bit more proactive by having made the cast and rather than just letting it sit underneath a little strike indicator. But those two methods, I highly recommend them, and I use them.
Great, great. Well, I think we'll call it a night. I know there's some more questions. I saw some questions online that we answered earlier in the show, so some of you may have arrived late. Go back, listen to the recording when we have that out there, and I think we'll fill in the blanks for you. But let's call it a night here, Michael. You've done a great job, but hang with me. For a few more minutes, we're going to give away a few prizes, and I want you to help me determine the winner on that one. So stick with us, folks. We're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and, of course, Michael's book, Effective Stillwater Fly Fishing, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So stick with me a couple more minutes. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's FamilyTYES.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website, please take a minute to give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what do you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. And the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. Now, if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So first, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. A great organization to be part of. And so even if you don't win tonight, check that out and become a member. Our winner for that is Carl Taylor in Utah. Carl Taylor in Utah. So congratulations, Carl. Hold on, folks. I just ran out of something to write here. Carl Taylor in Utah. So congrats. And we'll get connected with you. And the next thing we're going to give away is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. If you want to find out more about Amato and what they have to offer, go to AmatoBooks.com. And our winner for this is Dale Scala. Dale Scala in North Carolina. So congrats, Dale. And now let's give away Michael's book. Let me clear my queue here. And so here's the question. Michael talked about his favorite patterns for Calabatus nymphs. Give me two of them. Two of his favorite patterns for Calabatus nymphs, and you'll win Michael's book. Okay, so Michael, now I'm waiting for answers here. And checking. Wow. Okay, hey, we got one here. And let's, we have answers, Calabatus, epoxy black Calabatus nymph. Is that one of them?
Yeah, epoxy back, yes.
And flashback pheasant tail nymph?
Yes, sir.
And how about also, this? Treg's going for extra credit here. flashback hare's ear and bird's nest.
That man paid attention.
He paid attention. He always does. He wins a lot. He won the last show, too. Treg, you're on it again. What can I say? And let's just see if anybody else came in here. Yeah, Sean, hare's ear and pheasant tail, you're correct, too. You're just a little late. You guys got to be faster than Treg. He's, like, super fast. He's got some kind of system going on, I know, by now. He's got some kind of system. Anyway, hey, Treg, you're good to go again, and please send me your address again because I don't save that stuff, but please send me your address again so we can get Michael's book out to you. I know you're going to enjoy it. Treg listens to, I think, every show live, so he's an excellent listener. Hey, Michael, thanks again for being with us tonight, and I enjoyed talking with you, and sounds like there was much more to talk about from the questions coming in, but just not enough time.
I was just getting warmed up, Roger.
You were just getting warmed up.
But I
well, you did a great job. Yeah,
you Thank
did
you
a
very
great
much.
Job. So, folks, if you are new to Ask About Fly Fishing, be sure to check out our archive. We've got, I think, over 190 shows in the archive now. So just go to the archive. It's at the bottom of every page. You'll see it, and you can search by keyword phrases and find about anything you want, from fish types or species to names of rivers or lakes or whatever, and techniques, and check it all out. I'm sure you'll be surprised at how much information we have out there. Our next broadcast is going to be on August 6th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And the show is yet to be determined, so you'll have to watch the site and look for emails, and we'll let you know what it is. We've got a couple of people negotiating for slots there, so we'll let you know as soon as we know, and we'll get that taken care of. We would like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Platte River Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, and Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673. That's 1-800-985-1673. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.